The U.S. Supreme Court took oral arguments yesterday on challenges to a Texas abortion law. The law, which went into effect on September 1st, is the most restrictive in the nation. The law, in effect, outsources enforcement to private citizens, which makes it difficult to challenge in court. The Supreme Court initially declined to stop the law, although liberal justices called it unconstitutional. Now, after yesterday's arguments, it's possible that Texas abortion providers will be able to sue over it. All of this comes just a month before another big abortion case comes before the court, Dobbs versus Jackson, which is a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade in a law in Mississippi. We're talking about the new restrictive abortion laws coming before the Supreme Court and what it will mean for the future of abortion law in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this Texas abortion law? What are your thoughts? What do you want to know about what the Supreme Court has said about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mary Ziegler is the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at the Florida State University College of Law. She's one of the leading authorities on the legal history of abortion in America. Her most recent book is called Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to put this Supreme Court hearing yesterday in context. They're not about to, if I understand correctly, Mary, rule for or against the constitutionality of the law. They're just deciding whether somebody could sue over it in federal court. Do I have that right?
That's right. Yeah. So Texas had basically said this was sort of like a bulletproof abortion ban. So Texas could ban abortion and then no one can go to federal court to do anything about it. So one question may be, well, who cares? Can't they go to state court? And that's true. But then it sort of turns into a game of whack-a-mole where one abortion provider can be sued by a whole bunch of different people for each abortion they perform, and they have to raise a constitutional defense each time before a different judge. So there's never a kind of final solution as to whether this law is okay or not. So the question was really whether there's a route for federal courts to take to tell us whether this law is constitutional, not actually the substance of the law. The court isn't going to get to that.
What kind of things did Supreme Court justices say in their questioning?
Well, the justices, so we were watching in particular Justices Barrett and Kavanaugh. Justice Kavanaugh has emerged, I wouldn't say as the swing justice, but probably the median justice. So the justice who's in the majority most of the time, as much as 85% of the time, which is a lot. So Justice Kavanaugh was asking questions that didn't seem good for Texas, primarily questions about whether a kind of SB8 style law could exist for guns or the free exercise of religion or the First Amendment. So essentially the idea is if Texas can nullify a constitutional right, can Massachusetts nullify another constitutional right? And that really seemed to be giving Justice Kavanaugh pause. Justice Barrett seemed to have similar concerns. So this is a situation where we may see not only 5 votes that abortion providers can sue, but potentially up to 6 votes.
I want to give a listen to Justice Kavanaugh on that issue. Here's a listen.
It could be free speech rights. It could be free exercise of religion rights. It could be Second Amendment rights. If this position is accepted here, the theory of the amicus brief is that it can be easily replicated in other states that disfavor other constitutional rights.
Can you talk a little more about the unique way that this law is enforced that puts it in that position and that could be replicated for, as Justice Kavanaugh was saying, other constitutional issues in other states?
Yeah, so SB 8 essentially says we're going to ban this procedure, abortion, but the state's not going to enforce the law. Private citizens are going to enforce the law by bringing lawsuits. And literally anyone can do that. Then the question, so Texas then is arguing this theory or this art called sovereign immunity. So it's pretty difficult to sue states directly in federal court. The only exception to that is if you sue a state, if you can seek an injunction against a state official who's enforcing an unconstitutional law. Texas is then saying, well, look, no state officials can enforce our law, only private citizens can. So there's no way to get this into federal court. But if that's true, then, you know, like I was saying, Massachusetts could say, okay, you have a right to own a handgun in your home, but we're going to say you can't. And if you do, anyone who finds out can sue you and get a minimum of $10,000 each time you have a handgun in your home. And federal courts can't do anything about it. Or, you know, you can't go to church and federal courts can't do anything about it. or you can't put a political sign on your yard. You know, I mean, it could go on and on, right? And so I think that was the concern Justice Kavanaugh had, that if Texas makes it impossible for people to get to court, federal court, other states will copy that plan.
Talking to Mary Ziegler from the Florida State University College of Law, looking at abortion cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. A Texas law came to the court yesterday with oral arguments. That'll just determine if abortion providers in Texas can sue in federal court over that law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following these cases as they come to the U.S. Supreme Court? Are you hopeful or worried about the outcome, what it could mean for Roe v. Wade itself and abortion laws in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country? Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mary, before we turn to Mississippi, this Texas law, supposing that the Supreme Court justices say, yes, you can sue over this law in Texas, presumably, ultimately, it finds its way to the U.S. Supreme Court again. What would a timeline look like on something like that?
It could take quite a while, right? So most likely, the court is actually going to let SB 8 stay in effect. So most likely, what it's going to do is say, we're going to just send this whole thing back to the trial court and let the proceedings continue now that we know that the abortion providers can sue. So they're going to probably try to get an injunction, basically block the law while the litigation continues. They're probably going to lose that in the Fifth Circuit, which is very conservative. Then they're going to appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and eventually they'll wind up getting a ruling on whether you can constitutionally ban abortion at 6 weeks or not. That then would get appealed too. So why all of that matters is because the Texas and the Mississippi case are happening within a pretty small window. And the court may have an answer in the Mississippi case as to whether there even is a right to abortion at all by the time we even figure out the ultimate answer on SB 8.
Right. And that takes us to the Mississippi law. Can you tell us, so what is at stake here and when is it coming before the Supreme Court?
So the Mississippi law, if you were tired of thinking about abortion, unfortunately, you're not going to get much of a break because the oral argument in the Mississippi case is December 1st, and we're likely to get a decision on the SB 8 case before that. The Mississippi case involves a law banning abortion at 15 weeks. What's significant is that Roe v. Wade and the cases following it hold that there's a right to abortion until viability, which is 24 weeks. That's clearly much later than 15 weeks. So for the court to uphold Mississippi's law, as many expect them to do, they either have to say that there is no right to choose abortion or that that right doesn't apply all the way until viability. So that would mean either rewriting Roe v. Wade or just eviscerating Roe v. Wade entirely. Either of those things would be a pretty big deal.
Has the court tipped its hand at all, or at least court justices tipped their hands at all, about how they would approach a case like Mississippi's?
Well, I mean, simply the fact that the court took the case is tipping its hand in a way, because we have six conservative justices on the court. States have been teeing up literally like a menu of options for the justices to choose. So if they want to go slowly and it chipping away at abortion rights, they have an option. If they want to go quickly, they have an option. Mississippi was the quickly option. The fact that the court took that, there's no way for the court to uphold the Mississippi law without doing something major. And so the very fact that the court chose to take this case suggests that they're ready to do something big on abortion.
How much of an impact on abortion in the United States would, or say in a state like Mississippi, would a 15-week dividing line be?
Well, a 15-week dividing line would not have that much of an effect in the sense that most abortions take place before the 12th week of pregnancy, upwards of 90%. The issue is that no one really seriously believes that the court would stop at 15 weeks, that the result would essentially be, okay, guess what? 15 weeks is now the new line. Viability is not. So you can't ban abortion before 15 weeks, but you can after 15 weeks. Nobody actually thinks that's what's going to happen. If the court doesn't overrule Roe this year, they will probably be laying the groundwork for overruling Roe in the years to come. And so that could obviously have a much more significant effect because there, you know, between 20 and 25 states that are poised to eliminate almost all abortions if Roe is gone, including at periods in pregnancy when the procedure is a lot more common.
Mary Ziegler is with us, professor at Florida State University's College of Law, one of the leading authorities on the legal history of abortion in the U.S. She's talking to us about the U.S. Supreme Court's possible decision to allow challenges to Texas's abortion law and a case coming from Mississippi at the beginning of next month to the Supreme Court. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. This case coming next month from Mississippi is a pretty fundamental challenge to Roe v. Wade. What do you want to know about that case? How justices might vote? What do you think? What do you hope comes out of these decisions? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Florida State University law professor Mary Ziegler about Roe v. Wade, which established abortion as a constitutional right. It's being challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court. They heard arguments in a Texas case about whether it could be Texas could be sued over a law in effect. And Mississippi, a case coming at the beginning of next month. And we want to hear what you think about all this or what you want to know about all this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julie in Janesville couldn't stay on the line but had a question about in that Texas case, where or the Texas law, where does the $10,000 reward come to for the person reporting this? Julie wonders, is there a state official attached to it who would be the one included in an injunction? But Mary, as I understand it, if you're that citizen who reports abortion that would violate that law, you'd be suing the provider for $10,000. Do I have that right?
That's right. And that's why the providers don't want to perform the abortions, because, I mean, it's worth saying $10,000 is the floor. Mm-hmm. It may be that you could get more than $10,000, depending on the judge, et cetera. Right. So the people who the abortion providers are arguing are the state actors doing the enforcing. They pick the clerks who have to docket the cases. Right. So when you go to file a lawsuit, there's a court administrator who actually has to take your paperwork and put the process in motion. They're arguing that those are the best people to view as state officials. They're obviously involved in every case for it to actually get rolling.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Brad, hi.
I don't know if this is germane to the conversation, but I just find it highly hypocritical of the Republicans who en masse are looking to say a fetus is a child, and yet they're pro-life, and at the same time, almost en masse, they oppose vaccine mandates for their children and mask mandates for their children. And I will take my comment off air.
Brad, thanks for the call. I don't think those direct arguments would be coming up in these cases, Mary, but do you see, I don't know, any philosophy behind that matches up with what Brad is seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been a kind of resurgence of conservative arguments about my body, my choice, which obviously are in some tension with arguments that are being made in these cases. I think conservative lawyers would argue essentially that they would argue that there's another person being harmed in abortion as they see it. Obviously, people who believe in vaccine mandates think that unvaccinated people are injuring other people as well by putting them at risk for COVID. People who are opposed to vaccine mandates tend to disbelieve that. So this is a sort of a scenario where I think, unfortunately, people are living in different, almost factual universes when it comes to these questions in ways that make it hard for them to even have useful conversations.
It's going out to Harry in Rochester. Harry, hi.
Hi, thank you. My question has to do with this term constitutional right to an abortion. I understand that the Constitution specifically spells out my right to freedom of religion, freedom of speech, right to own, keep and bear arms. How does a court decision, Roe v. Wade, how does that equate to a constitutional right because the court made a decision?
Harry, thanks for the call. That's an interesting question, Mary.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's a whole variety of constitutional rights that the court has recognized that are not in the text of the Constitution. So the caller's point is a good one, but it applies to the right to marry. It applies to the right to parent. It applies to the right to use birth control. It applies to the right to cohabit with your family. And so The court has sort of taken it upon itself to say that there are rights beyond the ones spelled out in the text of the Constitution. And justices across the ideological spectrum, from conservatives to progressives, more or less agree that that's true. Like, you're not going to find a justice on the Supreme Court who says, oh, by the way, there is no right for anyone to marry or parent. I mean, that's not going to happen. So the question is more, how do you identify those rights? Like, what methods do you use? And that's really the terms of the debate about Roe. It's not whether there are no rights beyond the ones in the 10 amendments and the 14th Amendment. It's really about how we identify rights, full stop.
Thanks for the call, Harry. And there's been some question, Mary, and I know in Supreme Court confirmation hearings, a lot of questions on the topic of when the U.S. Supreme Court can or should overturn a precedent set by a former Supreme Court. Do facts have to change? Does something have to fundamentally change before they can change a ruling? And that seems like it's a big question for Roe v. Wade.
Right. Rules. So generally speaking, the court is not just supposed to overrule a previous opinion because it's wrong. Because unsurprisingly, then every time the court's membership changed, the court would go around overruling everything. So instead, the standard is supposed to be that there's some plus factor. So the case is unworkable, no one relies on it, or the facts or the law have changed in ways that make it deserving of reconsideration. So Mississippi and its allies have all kinds of arguments on that score. Essentially, they say birth control is better and more available than it used to be. There's more options available for working mothers than there used to be, particularly those who are unmarried. So their argument in some ways is that people don't need abortion rights anymore. They also argue that abortion is actually bad for people who are pregnant and for women, such that there's no reason they would rely on it or should rely on it because it actually harms them.
Talking to Mary Ziegler from Florida State University, looking at the latest in the U.S. Supreme Court on abortion laws in Texas and Mississippi. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us now in Ellison Bay. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I think origin stories matter. And there's the history of how we got here. I literally never hear it discussed. I don't see it in the media. I don't see it in literature. I think it's crucial to understanding the politics of how we landed at this spot. Mary, I don't know if that's something that you get into or you have any background with, but my understanding is that the beginning with the Catholic Church, that the churches changed their stances on the kind of the beginning of life, the spark. This isn't something that was historically true. This happened in the middle of the 1800s, and it was in response to politics happening here in the U.S., where they were approached about changing it. I mean, I don't know if you've got any, like I said, of any background on that, but this is a really big deal, because prior to that, quickening, which is somewhere around 20, 22 weeks, was considered to be the time that, you know, life or the soul entered the body. And that change was driven by politics here in the United States. Is that something that's explored or discussed at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the religious politics of abortion have changed a lot. So we tend to think, I think now most people would equate the anti-abortion or right to life movement with Catholicism, or even more with evangelical Protestantism, particularly with white evangelical Protestants. Both of those things were not always true. As the caller points out, the Catholic position on abortion evolved over time. White evangelical Protestants changed their position even more recently. So even in the decade after Roe v. Southern Baptist Convention, which is the convention in the world, was not opposed to all abortions. It was opposed to what it called abortion on demand, but supported access to abortion in scenarios like rape, incest, threat to the patient's health, and so on. So even that was not something that existed before Roe or even after Roe. So I think that was the essence of, so it was an important change, and it was a change that we can't attribute to Roe itself.
Thanks a lot for that call, Elizabeth. In our last couple of minutes, Mary, we could see decisions, very big decisions coming out, I guess, next year, just in time for midterm elections, potentially next year. How big an impact would a dramatic change of Roe v. Wade have on American politics, do you think?
I mean, it could be quite big. Obviously, polling data tell us that most Americans sort of like where we are, which is to say with abortion being legal but restricted. Most polling data suggests that Americans are ambivalent on abortion. So they may like Roe v. Wade, they may like the idea of legality, but they also don't like the idea of unrestricted access to abortion. And that's kind of where, what we have right now. So if the Supreme Court reverses Roe, that's likely to be quite unpopular, both because people seem to support Roe and because people don't seem to like the idea of bans, which is what we would get in a lot of states in a world without Roe. The only variable, of course, is that elections don't necessarily reflect only abortion, so we'd have to see what other issues there are at the time. And because our landscape is becoming so polarized, there's only a small handful of voters whose vote is really up for grabs, right? So how much those voters would care about abortion will be hard to predict ahead of time. It may mostly be a question of turnout, whether people who care about this issue are going to be fired up because of something the Supreme Court, that something the Supreme Court does in a way that isn't usually the case.
And Mary, if the Supreme Court hears a case starting on December 1st, when are we likely to hear a ruling on this Mississippi case?
The Mississippi case, we're likely to get an answer by the end of June of 2022. We're likely to hear about the SBA case much sooner than that, maybe by the end of this month. But the Mississippi case, which I think is the main event here, will probably take until this summer.
Mary, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, as always. My pleasure.
Mary Ziegler is the Stearns Weaver Miller Professor at Florida State University's College of Law. She's one of the leading authorities on the legal history of abortion in America. Her most recent book is called Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Still time for you to share your thoughts on these cases. You can email ideas@WPR.org.